welcome to Home Fires Radio Show. It is our privilege to have in Fairbanks with us this week Janine Roth. She is the author of Breaking Free and, prior to that, Feeding the Hungry Heart. And this is your second trip to Fairbanks. Janine, welcome.
Thank you.
Welcome back.
Thank you. It's really good to be back.
Janine hates cold. I mean, hates cold. She's a true Californian from Santa Cruz, and she came armed with all of this special long underwear and wonderful fur mittens and so on. And when I went to pick her up this morning, I said, Janine, we are closing in on record high temperatures. And she said, well, how warm is it? I said, almost up to freezing.
Patty, you said it was balmy. So this isn't exactly balmy weather to me. I left 75-degree sleeveless top and short weather.
Well, I'm as weird as the rest of them. But it is balmy to me. This is April weather and a real gift. And Janine feels that someone's being real nice to her up there to give her this weather.
Yes, I tell Patty you can hold me responsible for this weather.
Well, thanks. I appreciate it. I don't know how all the dog mushers and all the skiers like this, but for the rest of us, it's great.
Mm-hmm.
Welcome. You were here before a year and a half?
No, it was
ago?
May of 83.
May of 83.
It was actually the very first weekend workshop that I did away from Santa Cruz. And so that it was a real beginning for me. And so it's lovely to be back here again because so much has happened in between then and now.
Another book.
And really, most of what I do now is travel. I travel all across the United States at least once a month and usually a few weeks a month to different cities, different states, leading workshops. I'm starting to work for bigger corporations now, insurance companies, teaching their staff how to deal with their employees in a very sensitive and gentle way around food instead of you've got to lose weight, you've got to weigh yourself, and this is what you need to do. So I'm really starting to branch out. I'm also dealing with survivors of child sexual abuse with eating disorders and adult children of alcoholics with eating disorders.
Everyone has seemingly an increased interest in the total person, your reference to corporations hiring you to come and address that issue, and the understanding that if people are healthier and they feel better about themselves, they'll be better workers,
mm-hmm.
I guess is.
Yeah.
Is
yeah, I was reading on the plane yesterday coming up from Anchorage an article about how the bigger corporations are hiring massage therapists now.
Really?
To be there to give massages from something like 7:30 in the morning till 9, and then 10-minute neck and back rubs.
I think I'm going to turn this into the suggestion box. Up at the university. This is the way to improve morale here. We need our own masseuse, right? Carla thinks that's a great idea. A legion of masseuses, roving masseuses. You can call them up and have them do your neck.
Especially in 10 minutes. They do 10-minute neck and back rubs.
Especially, I think, for those people who do very concentrated work at a desk,
yes.
Don't get an opportunity to move around a lot. Just the sameness of the position
yes.
can be...
Yes.
Really stressful. For the sake of our audience, let's back way up from here and from where we are at this moment and talk about body image, maybe or wherever you think is the sort of basic place we should stop to talk about this issue.
Well, I think the first thing to do is define what I do. And I'll start off by defining what compulsive eating is. Compulsive eating is eating when you're not hungry, not stopping when you've had enough. So it's not as scary as it sounds. People often get turned off by the word compulsion. They don't want to identify themselves as somebody who's compulsive about anything. It's hard. It's a difficult label to put on yourself. And as an aside, I'm thinking about changing the title of what I do to emotional eating, because I think that is really what it is. When people are compulsive about food and eating when they're not hungry, they're doing it for emotional reasons. They're not listening to their body, but they're hungry for something else. So I begin with the very basic conviction that people eat for good reasons. People eat to take care of themselves. They eat to protect themselves. They eat to express something that they don't know how to say any other way. And often we've started as a child. So the basic thing is you're eating for a good reason. What is it? Instead of, I'm crazy, I don't have willpower, I'm self-destructive,
bad.
I'm bad. And that whole line of judgment only leads to more eating.
Right.
It could
Guilt
lead to
eating.
A diet, which could lead to a binge, which could lead to a diet, which could lead to a binge. I always say that for every diet, there's an equal and opposite binge. And I think that's true. A woman in a workshop says all she has to do is think about dieting, and she binges. Think about it. Just think about eating broccoli and cottage cheese and salads, and she goes right to the refrigerator.
That's true. And that's why people sort of put diets on a special day and then go crazy, like Monday.
Yes.
Because, I mean, Mondays are
right.
blue, grim, whatever,
right.
that people think just getting back into the routine. And so they'll eat wildly all weekend in anticipation of
yes.
this deprivation.
Yes, yes. Yes, it's amazing. Some people even do that when they come to before they come to a workshop. If they know they're coming to a workshop with me, they're so used to associating what's going to help them feel better about themselves with food and lose weight to dieting that they think I'm going to tell them how to diet, which I don't. Another basic conviction is that diets don't work. Diets teach you, first of all, how to binge. It's like putting something in a black box, covering it with velvet, walking out of the room and telling the person who's still sitting in the room, don't look at this black box no matter what you do. And that's what diets do. They really give us the urge to binge because they create such deprivation. So diets lead to binges.
We are a nation of dieters.
Yes, we are.
I read some statistics, and I may be off a few percentage points here, but that something in the range of 90% of the young women of college age have been on at least one diet in their life before reaching college. Now, I would assume that does not mean that they were all dangerously or even unpleasantly overweight, but their own idea of themselves.
Right. By the time I reached college age, I had been probably about 35 or 40 diets. So I think one diet is a real conservative estimate. I only knew one person when I was in school who hadn't been on a diet. And that was one person out of all of the women that I met. Glamour magazine did a survey a few years ago, and they interviewed 33,000 women. They found that of 33,000, 75% of them felt that they were too fat and needed to diet. 66% of the underweight women also wanted to go on a diet. So, and the other interesting thing about the survey was that they asked four questions. Well, actually, they asked one question. The question was, what would make you happiest? And they listed four choices. And the first one was success at work. The second one was intimacy in a relationship with a partner. The third was contact and connection with an old friend, and the fourth was losing weight. And something like 85% of the women checked losing weight, which meant losing weight over being successful at work, being in a relationship with somebody they really wanted to, and having a good conversation with an old friend. So there is a real obsession in our culture with losing weight.
Don't we think that if we lose weight, then we can go back to our high school
that's
reunion,
exactly
we can
what
develop
we think.
An intimate relationship, and we, of course, will be successful at work if we lose
that's
weight.
Right.
That's
right. And I
key.
Think that's that really is what people think. Well, if I have all these other things and I'm not thin, then they don't make a difference. But if I'm thin, then I'll be able to get all of these other things. And unfortunately, that doesn't turn out to be true. First of all, what people have found, especially those of us who have been on diets, is that we've been thin quite a few times, or been thinner quite a few times in our lives, lost and gained that weight 10 or 20 pounds, 10 or 20 times. I've lost and gained over 500 pounds. I think I've probably lost and gained over 1,000 pounds in my life. If being at a thin weight made me happy, then I and that was really the key to it, I would have stayed there. But that's not it. And the reason that I brought that up was just to show you how many people revolve their lives around dieting and being thin. And what happens is that they think so much about being thin that And this is the problem with compulsive eating. The world revolves around that. They get so hooked into that that other issues don't make a lot of difference. They become very self-absorbed. Relationships, things that could really make them happy, are centered out. I mean, they're just pushed out.
Obviously, not as many men have been on diets by the time they're 18 or 19. I'd like to speculate on why that difference. I mean, is it really that women have a lot more trouble controlling weight or use food more? Or
no, I don't think that's particularly true. I think there are a few things. A man has other things, other avenues with which to define himself, and does work, athletics. There are a whole bunch of external ways that he can value himself, that he can get credited for. A woman feels that if she's not thin, then nothing else matters.
Our body image is very important in the way others perceive us.
Yeah, who we are. And what many people in a workshop say is, I am what I weigh. I am my body. Now, that leads to, if you're 10 pounds or 20 pounds or 100 pounds overweight, feeling like a failure if you feel like you're overweight. Now, the catch-22 about that is that it's never possible to be thin enough. Therefore, it's never possible to feel like you're not a failure, because no matter what you look like, you always want to lose weight. If 66% of women who are underweight want to go on diets, that means there's no resting point. There's no point at which somebody stops and says, I'm thin enough, I'm good enough, I'm okay. Because your body weight doesn't make a lot of difference in being okay. We've got it very confused. We think that if we're thin, then we're going to be happy. What we really want is to be happy. We've got thinness confused with that. So we try to be thin in order to be happy. We don't realize that it happens from the inside out, not the outside in. And as a woman in another workshop said, I would die to be as thin as I was 5 years ago, when I would have died to have been thinner. That sense of never being good enough.
Gloria Vanderbilt, one of those.
Babe Paley.
Who said, you can never be too thin or too rich.
Mm-hmm,
and
that's
really stuck. Is Babe Paley really thin?
I think she probably is.
But not thin enough.
No, not according to her.
Actually, that brings us to another issue, anorexia, which is becoming a real problem for young women in our society, and bulimia. You want to talk about those two phenomena, the sort of other side of it?
Well, it's not really the other side. It's just a continuum. It is really a matter of extremes. Having been anorexic myself for a year and a half and gotten down to 88 pounds, eating 150 calories a day and jogging 3 miles a day, I really understand what that's about. But I do think it's important to see it as a continuum. Also, that when an anorexic or a bulimic is medically endangered, we're not just talking about just a little compulsive eating problem. We're talking about a life-threatening problem.
For our audience who may not be familiar with these two
by now
syndromes.
Very familiar terms, anorexia is self-starvation. It's really the giving up of food. Bulimia is binging and purging, eating a lot and throwing it up, or eating a lot and taking laxatives and, you know, purging yourself that way.
So you get the pleasure of eating, or at least the feeling of eating, and yet you do not keep those calories in your
right
body.
Something else has become very prominent, that's spitting out food, eating it, chewing it, and spitting it out so that you don't have to swallow it. That's what I've been hearing more and more of and about in the workshops.
Jane Fonda a few years ago revealed that she had been
bulimic
for years.
Uh-huh. Yeah, it's not anything that's new. Anorexia, the way that I see anorexia is, and this was certainly true for me, I was a classic anorexic. I became anorexic at a time in my life where I felt extremely out of control of all the variables in my life. I didn't know what I wanted to do. I didn't know where I wanted to live. I didn't know how I was going to make money. I didn't know anything about the direction that I was going into. I felt terribly, terribly out of control. I was also a high achiever, and I've always been a high achiever. I, you know, just kind of keep pushing myself, keep stretching myself beyond limits. That feeling of being a high achiever and feeling out of control at the same time was terribly difficult to stay with. And what I did was focus all my need to be in control of something on my body, so that, and because it was so under my control, and nothing else really is in our lives when you think about it. And that's why so many of our conflicts get acted out in the food and body arena, because when it comes to a relationship, when it comes to anything else but our bodies and what we put into it, we are not in absolute control. When it comes to somebody else, a work environment, anything, we're subject to other variables. When it comes to what we put in our mouths, nobody puts food in our mouth except us. We are in control of that. Absolutely in control. That is the only area. And so if you're feeling out of control in other areas of your life, and if feeling out of control is a very difficult feeling to tolerate, then for an anorexic, feeling in control gets translated to feeling in control of her body. And again, with bulimics, it's also an issue of control. I have a very close friend who's a bulimic, who still is a bulimic, although she's been tailoring off in about the past 5 years. She has a PhD in an academic field. She's very well. She's a full-fledged professor at a university. And she has this drive to succeed. She works hard. She gets up at 5:30 in the morning. She gets home. It's 8:30, 9 o'clock at night. She's been carefully controlled the whole day. And eating is her way of being out of control. It's her time for herself. When we don't give ourselves, especially with professional women, when we don't give ourselves time for ourselves, times to not do anything, when doing nothing is the best that you can do, when we don't give ourselves that, we create time. And because you have to eat, many people deal with those feelings of, you know, needing time with eating. People eat and read all the time. And when I ask people, why do you eat and read? Why don't you read and then eat, or eat and then read? Well, because I never give myself time to read, and I have to eat. So that gives me time to do both. And my response is, look at your life. Why is it that if you love reading, you've got no time to do that? And so it's those issues that we need to look at, the underlying issues, how we structure our lives so that we don't get enough of what we really want and what really nurtures us and nourishes us and fills us up. And so we turn to food to do that.
It seems sort of, paradoxical that we have all this. I mean, this is a nation of fast food. It's everywhere. You can drive in your car. You can pick it up on the fly. More and more meals that in the frozen food section of most supermarkets is increasing. It seems yearly they tear out another shelf and put in fast, easy to prepare fast foods. And of course, microwave ovens have made a tremendous difference in that. And more families that I know say that they have a hard time finding an hour when the whole family can be together and eat. Whereas when I was growing up, and I think our family wasn't exceptional, dinner time was sort of a sacred time. I mean, you did come home and you sat at the table and you ate. That was like the minimum of family contact that at least you had daily. That seems to be creating a situation where we're eating and not being aware of it.
We're getting very fast-paced. Everything is fast, fast, fast. And I think what this is speaking of is a need to slow down a little bit. I don't necessarily think it's important for families to eat together. I think the emphasis on having to have dinner together creates a lot of stress and strain. And what ends up happening is that the dinner hour ends up being a time where people end up crying or yelling at each other or talking about emotional things, and nobody gets to digest the food, and the food is secondary. And, you know, I don't feel like it's important. I think that families need to work out a time to be together. But eating together does not necessarily imply being together. And for many families, it does. That's the only time they've got together. And again, if that's the only time you've got together, it's time to look again. How are you structuring your time so that you're not getting time to be together? Doesn't have to be through food. A lot of mothers don't quite know what to do, you know, because my program is really based on eating what you want, eating when you're hungry, stopping when you've had enough. Well, unfortunately, when we get hungry is not always regulated at 8 o'clock in the morning, 12 o'clock noon, and 6 o'clock at night. It's not always like that. And for people with families, it's very difficult to figure out how to eat when you're hungry and how to eat with your family, too. It's not important to eat with your family all the time. And I think that certainly it's very nice to have family occasions and family dinners, but as a rule, you know, needing that ritual every day creates a lot of stress. There's no need to do that.
Do you think people are aware of their nutritional intake when they are eating on the move all the time?
No, that's the other thing. Eating in a car, for instance. I have a lot of people who do a lot of their eating in a car. And they eat in the car for a few reasons. One is because nobody can see them eating in the car. And so that's their private place. The other is that they can eat a lot and not be aware of what they're eating. Anytime your attention is going outside of you, it's not going inside of you. If it's going out to breaking and shifting and not bumping into the car in front of you and watching that the guy next to you doesn't slam into you, then you're not paying attention to the food that you're putting into your mouth. Now, but that's the good reason to do it. For people who don't want to pay attention to what's going into their mouth. See, a lot of us are afraid that if we really noticed how much we'd be eating, we'd be horrified. We wouldn't be able to eat as much. And that's true. When you start really noticing what you're putting into your mouth, you can't believe how much you're putting into your mouth, that you don't realize you're putting into your mouth. And so we create these little scenarios where we can do it without being aware of doing it. A woman in a workshop told a story last week that I thought was hysterical. She was in her car eating, and her car was littered with bags and boxes and soda pop cans, and she got stopped by a policeman. And he looked in her window, and he looked at her car, which looked like a veritable grocery store, except it was just empty, everything's, and he said, "What are you doing?" And she, having taken my workshop and committed herself to telling the truth, looked him straight in the eye and said, "I'm binging." And he said, "You certainly are." And she said that has cured her of eating in the car forever.
No place is sacred anymore.
No. Not when somebody actually catches you in the act. And you suddenly realize what you're doing. Unfortunately, we don't catch ourselves in the act. See, if she had been able to look at herself and say, "What am I doing? Why do I need to eat like this in the car?" But it took somebody else looking at the boxes and the bags and the wrappers littered and strewn everywhere in her car to help her realize that she was doing something that was, you know, not helping her at all.
Your first book, Feeding the Hungry Heart, is a series of accounts of women who have shared with you some of their experiences. And there are several recountings in there of women who go to great lengths, like putting hasp and padlock on their refrigerator, because it's as if some part of their mind turns off when they start these eating frenzies.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, the whole act of binging feels like you're being possessed by something. You're not the same person that you were before you started binging. There's a feeling that I had when I was binging that if anybody stood in my way, I would mow them down. They better get out of my way now if they knew what was good for them, because I felt like I could have just been a lawnmower. The need for food at those moments is so urgent and so strong that I guess people feel that unless they lock up their cabinets, they're just going to be a vacuum cleaner. Unfortunately, locking up cabinets doesn't help when you get that need or urge to binge. Oftentimes, they'll do anything. I mean, so you lock a cabinet, you'll go out at 3 o'clock in the morning and get food. I once, when I was on Weight Watchers, gave my next-door neighbor the gallon of Weight Watchers ice cream that I was eating. And she left. And then half an hour later, I was seized with a desire to have this Weight Watchers ice cream. And I had to get a ladder. And because she lived in a loft on top of a really tall building. And I had to climb up and break in her house to get the Weight Watchers ice cream. Now, you know, when I look at that story again, I think, what was going on? I could have just gone to the store. I mean, the store was 2 minutes away from me. I could have gotten another gallon of it. But suddenly, I felt possessed. And that's how many people feel.
Sort of frantic image that we've seen much, much more commonly depicted as someone running out of cigarettes and running through. And when I was a smoker, in fact, I did that. Well, I tried never to run out of cigarettes in the first place. But on the rare occasions that I did, I'd go through every pocket of every coat, jacket, shirt that you've...
Yes.
Ever worn in the last 6 months, you know, and find all these sort of fuzzy lifesavers.
And you know, right.
Ticket stubs.
Fuzzy lifesavers. And what that speaks of is two things. One is that depriving ourselves, dieting leads to binging. Telling yourself, now it's obviously different with smoking. But telling yourself you can't have this and you can't have that and you can't have this is fine when you're feeling strong and everything in your life is humming along. As soon as something goes wrong, which is bound to do for each of us almost every day, something is going to go wrong. And if it doesn't for a few days, then it will on the fifth day or the eighth day or the tenth day. Then suddenly that resolve is broken and it's like a crack has come in. And then there's this built-up well of deprivation, and everything that you didn't allow yourself to eat while you were holding yourself in so well for 10 days, suddenly that's what you have to eat right now. And so you go for that. The second and underlying reason that people do that, besides the fact that they've been on a diet and they've deprived themselves and the deprivation leads to binging, is that it's what leads them to binge is usually an uncomfortable emotion or situation, circumstance that happens in their lives. And we're not taught to deal with that. We don't know how to deal with things that are uncomfortable except by doing something about them and trying to make the discomfort go away by smoking a cigarette, by taking a drink, by eating a bowl of ice cream or a gallon of ice cream or a piece of pizza or a whole pizza. We don't know what to do with painful kinds of feelings or situations. We're not taught that it's okay, that pain is part of being alive. It comes with the territory. Nobody tells us that. We want to kiss it and make it go away. We want to take this pill and make the pain go away. You know, the things that are tooted in our culture are things that are painkillers. Make the pain go away instantly. And that's what we believe about day-to-day pain as well. And so when it happens, we've got to push it away. And for an eater, what pushes it away, what numbs it, is food.
You concentrate on another kind of sensory.
Yes.
Experience.
And what happens is that you then switch the pain. Ultimately, you switch the pain from being in pain about what you were in pain about, which could be a rejection or sadness or loneliness, to now you're, and which is unfamiliar and you don't know what to do with that.
And you have no control over that.
Right. To now being in pain about something that you're familiar about, your body, and that you are in control over. So you switch the pain. It's not like one is better than the other. It's just that one is more familiar.
Okay, the pain comes from eating the cake and then feeling bad about it.
Right.
That's the replacement pain.
Right, right.
Oh, my God, I don't believe I ate the whole thing.
Again.
Again.
This is hopeless. A feeling of hopelessness. That's what I see in workshops all the time. People, and I deal with people from 16 to 70 and pretty well equally distributed. And the ones in their 30s, 40s, 50s, and 60s who have been dieting for years and years and years. And, you know, by the time somebody reaches 30, they could have been dieting for 23 years. So we're not talking about something that is, you know, happens 28 to 30. We're talking about 20 years of dieting here. So when somebody's 50, that means, you know, a good 40 years of dieting and gaining it back. And the hopelessness of ever dealing with this, the hopelessness of ever resolving this, of eating like a normal person, is overwhelming. And the despair, the feeling of self-loathing, What can I do? I don't want to be in this body. I'm stuck in here. I want to unzip myself from it. And I'm hopeless. Nothing's going to work because nothing has worked. And it's very, very sad. What's not sad about it is that I know that this is resolvable. I don't have one doubt in the world. I absolutely know this because I was one of those people. And I never thought, if somebody told me 10 years ago that I'd be in Fairbanks, Alaska, talking about resolving and dealing with compulsive eating, I would have told them they were out of their minds because I felt like I was swimming underwater and drowning constantly.
In Breaking Free, you talk about the kinds of things that you can do to stop breaking this cycle. And, you know, maybe we need to continue where we are before we go on to this. But what are the first steps to, I mean, how do you get off of this, I need to be on a diet, I need to, one of the things about diets, I suppose, that are so appealing is because they do allow you to suspend your thought process. I mean, they are usually, if not mono-food diets, they are a limited number of foods that you can eat, limited quantities, and so you don't really have to think about it. They give you a list and you follow the list. And it's out of your control. I mean, even that part is out of your control. You eat just what they say, and either you can follow it and succeed, or you don't follow it, which, because they're so limited, they're hard to keep on for very long, and then you fail.
The first step, I think people need some kind of structure. It's very difficult to go from years of dieting to feeling like you're let loose in the candy store and it's supermarket sweep time and you can eat anything you want, as much of it as you want, whenever you want. I give people a list of eating guidelines to follow. That's the basic concrete structure of Breaking Free, is to eat when you're hungry. And then we spend a lot of time getting in touch with what hunger is, where do people feel it, how do they know they're hungry, what are the different levels of hunger, at which point do you eat when you're hungry? Do you eat when you're a little hungry? Do you eat when you're a lot hungry? Do you eat when you're ravenous? What happens when you eat at all of those different points?
How do you know you're hungry?
Hunger is a survival mechanism. If you don't know you're hungry, you're not hungry. It's that simple. Or if you don't know you're hungry, you can wait a little while. And your body will tell you in no uncertain terms. You need food to live. And your body is adapted to and pressed on and determined to live, at least for a while more here. And so it will let you know, first in a slow kind of low voice and then in a screaming voice, I need food right now. And if you let it get too far, you'll feel like you eat anything that isn't nailed down because you start panicking. Your body goes into a kind of, I need food.
Don't people who have been on a lot of diets, isn't that one of the feelings of being on a diet, that you're always hungry?
I mean, that's a real psychological kind of hunger. Okay. I'm always hungry. And there's a difference between mind hunger and body hunger. And what I'm talking about is really learning how to listen to your body, how to trust your body. If you listen to your mind looks at a cheesecake and says, I want the whole thing, or I want this huge piece. You eat a few bites and your body says, I've had enough. It's up to you at that point who to listen to, but your body's talking the whole time. We've just covered it up with so many other voices that we can't listen to that. I teach people how to listen to that voice again, how to eat when you're hungry, to eat sitting down. Eating sitting down is a real important part of not eating compulsively because, again, when you stand up, you're doing other things. First of all, you're standing up. Second of all, you're probably standing up doing something else, eating at the stove, talking to somebody, involved with something else. So your attention is outside, not inside. Very important to sit down. I sit down in some of the strangest places when I eat because I realize, and if I don't want to eat compulsively, sometimes I do eat compulsively. But if I'm really wanting to taste the food and listen to my body, I sit down. And if it's important, then you pull up a chair in front of the refrigerator and you sit down in front of the refrigerator and you eat if you have to eat picking from the refrigerator.
But you're really announcing to yourself, okay, now I'm going to eat.
Now I'm going to eat. This is real.
This is
not picking off somebody else's plate. This is not grazing from the refrigerator. This is not anything but eating. We are eating now.
for a lot of women who are home with children, they're preparing food. I mean, this is sort of a traditional thing. They prepare the food for the kids, and then they clean up afterwards. And there can be a lot of – you can actually sit during the meal with a very small amount on your plate, but you've done all the tasting beforehand and all of the finishing up the peanut butter sandwiches and so on afterwards because you don't want to throw it out.
Uh-huh.
So I think for women that's a special risk. They can be a lot of
so an, another guideline is eat only until you've had enough. So that doesn't mean finishing the peanut butter sandwiches. That means being able to throw food out. That means – or being able to give it to the dog, the cat, or somebody else, or wrap it up. But it does mean leaving food over, not finishing everything that's on your plate and everybody else's plate around you. You know, I say you either throw it out or you throw it in. Either way, it's waste. If you throw it into your body and you've already had enough, then your body turns it to waste. If you throw it out then and you just put it down the garbage disposal or in the garbage can, then it's waste too. But either way, it's waste. It's no more sanctimonious to put it into your body, who turns it into waste, than to put it into the garbage pail, where it already is waste.
Mm-hmm. Makes a lot of sense. One of the things that you ask your people to do in your workshops when they first start, or one thing that you did yourself, is you gave yourself permission to eat anything that you
want. Right. That's another guideline. Eat only what you want. And, you know, for people who have been on diets for 2 years or 10 or 40 years, that is terrifying because people who have been on diets associate eating what they want with what they haven't been allowed to have. Immediately, it becomes what I haven't been allowed to have. It's no longer connected with what I'm hungry for in the moment. It's what I wasn't allowed to have for 10 years, and now I'm going to eat all I want, and I don't care what anybody else says.
What happened to you when you first said that to
yourself? 2 weeks of chocolate chip cookies. I ate raw batter dough, and I ate cook cookies and raw cookies and cook cookies and raw cookies and cook cookies. And I got sick. I mean, not really sick, but I was sick from chocolate chip cookies. It was a wonderful experience that I can now tell my workshops about and write about, and I'm glad I did it because I can talk about it a lot and use it as an example. I think if I had to do it again, well, I mean, it's hard to say if I had to do it again. What was true about those 2 weeks, and it was 2 weeks that I did this, was that I wasn't really listening to my body. I was eating to make up for
deprivation.
17 years. Of deprivation, just like people eat to store up for the deprivation that they might have tomorrow. You know, I'm going to go on and die tomorrow, so I better store up for all this deprivation that I'm going to feel and eat everything now. I was eating to make up for, and a lot of people do that. But eating what you want means being in the moment with yourself. And if you're hungry, really hungry, chances are a chocolate chip cookie is not going to satisfy that.
I'm sorry, I've failed to identify you here through the hour. I am speaking with Janine Roth. She is the author of Breaking Free and, prior to that, Feeding the Hungry Heart. She's here to do some workshops in Fairbanks. Okay, I'm sorry, I need to do that more frequently for my audience, and I get so involved in the conversation I forget.
Uh-huh.
Okay, so one of the things is to say, you can eat what you want, but that requires the secondary thing. Are you really hungry?
Yes, absolutely. People seem always to forget. When I was leading weekly workshops, what would happen is I'd give out the eating guidelines. We'd talk about them. People would go home and come in the next week, and they would have binged the whole week. And they said, but you told me to eat just what I wanted. And my response was, but I didn't say whenever you wanted. I said when you were hungry. And everybody forgets that. And that's a natural reaction. People usually forget that. I see three distinct stages of the breaking free process. The first stage is this feeling of rebellion and exhilaration and also panic and fear. Because finally being told you can eat whatever you want after years of not doing that, people rebel against depriving themselves.
And the other thing that happens at the very beginning is you say, you never have to diet again.
Right.
That's where the exhilaration
right.
comes
that's
from.
Right, that's the exhilaration.
From compulsive dieters.
Yes, yes.
That's,
and the fear comes from watching yourself eat and thinking that this is a binge because this looks like other binges and thinking this isn't going to work.
You don't have your list of telling you what you can and cannot eat.
And that this is just like everything else, and it's not going to work. That's the first stage. The second stage happens when people become much more comfortable listening to themselves. Their weight stabilizes. At the beginning, there's a possible weight gain. Not everybody gains weight, but some people do. The more they've deprived themselves, the greater the chances of gaining weight. Then their weight stabilizes in the second stage as they begin really listening to what they want to eat when they're hungry, listening to their body. And they also begin listening to the things that they want emotionally. So they see the tie in there. There's a real correlation between those two. Their weight stabilizes. They start feeling better about themselves. They're eating what they want, and they're not eating sugar all the time, which is what most people who have been on diets do. The third stage is when they lose weight, and they really feel like they're in touch with their bodies. People come in at different stages. Sometimes they come in at the beginning of stage one, at the end of stage one, at the beginning of stage two. I've seen so many people come through the whole process now that my belief in it is really strong. I ran into somebody a few months ago who had worked with me in a group and then lost 100 pounds, and I had not seen her since she lost 100 pounds, and she looked like a different person. And I said, how did you do it? And she said, by eating what I wanted when I was hungry. So she's somebody who came right through but who was terrified at the beginning that eating what she wanted was just going to lead to a 30-year binge.
I'll never, ever stop if I give myself permission
the fear.
To start.
I'm so scared my hunger is bottomless. If I really listen to myself, I'll never stop eating. I don't have whatever it takes, whatever other people have that tell them to stop. I don't have that. That's why I have to diet. And that's an erroneous belief. That is not true.
Well, and I think it's a really complicated process to divide eating from that whole emotional track that's going on, because we do in our society eat to celebrate, eat to kill the pain, eat to have something to do, eating as part of our social life. I mean, an inextricable part of our social life. So it really requires a giant step back to say, when am I going to participate and when am I not? Mm-hmm. It's really habitual.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, it certainly is habitual.
Now it's very difficult to have lunch, go to a cocktail party, and not pick at that stuff that's sitting there.
But you know what? I can do that now. Food has no attraction to me when I'm not hungry. I don't care what it is. It just, when I am hungry, watch out, because I'm really hungry. When I'm not hungry, I can be at parties. I was at one last week, and after I left, I realized that was no sweat. You know, before, 6 years ago, even when I first started this, I was scared to be around food. It was still scary to me. Food had a lot of power. Now I know I'm more powerful than food. I know that no matter how good something looks, if I'm not hungry, it's not going to be as good as it is when I am hungry. And I also know that when I get hungry again, there's going to be good food around. Often that feeling of needing to eat when you're not hungry at a cocktail party is that fear of missing something. This is going to be the best thing I ever could taste, and I'm going to miss it right now. What's true is that you miss it if you eat it when you're not hungry, because you don't really enjoy the taste of it fully. And what you can do in those situations, not particularly at cocktail parties, but at other places where you're not hungry, is take some of it home. Take a little bit home. Eat it when you are hungry.
I love some of your specific techniques. I myself have been on diets and then, of course, not ordered things or not put things on my plate, but taken a little bit off of someone else's. I'll just have a taste.
It doesn't count if it's off somebody else's plate.
Right.
I have a friend who I go out with, and we see each other pretty regularly. And after lunch, and I like dessert, and what I usually do is have two bites of dessert. And if it's a piece of cake, I bring it home, and it lasts me a week. I always say to my friend, "Do you want any dessert?" And he always says no. And the dessert comes, and I have two bites, and he finishes the whole thing. And it's just, it's he somehow can't say he wants it. He can't accept the fact that, yes, he wants dessert too. So when he eats mine, it's not the same thing as if he's ordered it himself. It's right. Very funny.
Doesn't count.
I've gotten to the point now with him where I don't even ask him. I just order dessert, and then I give him the rest when I'm done.
Okay. So your guidelines are, for the sake of our audience, who I hope go out and if this is an issue in your life, I hope you read Breaking Free, and I hope you read Feeding the Hungry Heart. But for those who might not, to just sort of run through, first to take an inventory of what really does go in your mouth, what you really do eat, and to say to yourself, I'm not going on a diet. I'm going to listen to my own body.
Yeah.
And then to eat when you're hungry. And I guess the part for a lot of us is to know when to stop. And your idea of really concentrating on the eating is going to really help that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Pay attention to the food. Eat without distractions. No reading, no watching television, no listening to music. And for those people who are eaters and readers and eaters and watchers, this is going to be a difficult one. A lot of people, I hear such groans when I say this. In a workshop, people say, but I can't do that, but I love eating and reading. And what you can do, and this is what I tell people, is take baby steps. If you're an eater and a reader, and the thought of not eating while you're reading is too much for you, decide that you're going to do it once a day, or you're going to do it 3 times this week, and see what happens. Don't make these huge proclamations like people do on diets. I'm going to go on a diet, and I'm going to lose 30 pounds in 3 weeks, and I'm going to get into that dress by the end of the month or those pants or whatever. Huge proclamations don't help.
It's one step at a time.
It's one step at a time, going slowly and building up the confidence in yourself.
I had a friend who, when you were here last time, she said, well, I have been on diets and off diets and so on so long, I don't think that my body would know if it was hungry, would know if it was full. I don't think my body's a good judge anymore, mm-hmm. basically, is what she was saying.
Which is sad. We don't believe in our bodies anymore. I mean, and that's what she's saying. I have messed around with my body so long, for so many years, that I'm not sure it still has a voice of its own. It does. And part of doing this is believing it's possible. You really cannot do anything that you don't believe you can do. When I was thinking about that with my books, I realized that although everybody said to me, you'll never get a book published, ever, and people said things like, somebody sent Charles Dickens' manuscript to Random House and under an assumed name, and they didn't like it, and they didn't accept it, and if they're not going to accept Charles Dickens' works, what makes you think they're going to accept your book? And I got a lot of that from people around me. But somewhere I believed that my writing was good and that I had something to say and that my book would get published. With eating, if you believe that you can do this, if you believe that it's resolvable, if you want to badly enough, you will. But the first step is believing that it's possible, that you've got that voice, that you can trust yourself, that you are somebody who is powerful, who can be responsible. The first step is that belief in yourself, in your own abilities, in your own power, in your own willingness to learn about yourself. That's the first step. Because that's what needs to pull you through all the times when you're not, to say to yourself, but this is the way I know it is. If I go back to dieting, something in me is going to die.
Mm-hmm. Let the people who eat to, in fact, make some kind of statement with their body. I mean, Gloria Steinem talks about a whole period in her late teens, early 20s, when she was very overweight. And she said she was really doing that, she thinks, after the fact, to keep men away, to keep herself out of a social life that made her very nervous and that she was very secure in. So that would sort of give her an excuse. Now, she said it wasn't conscious, of course, but that it really had a very positive effect for her at the time.
Mm-hmm. I think a lot of people do that. Survivors of child sexual abuse use their bodies to keep people away. It's very important if they feel like their bodies have been violated and abused. then there's an unconscious reasoning, which is a very good one, which says, if my body is big enough and ugly enough, no one will touch me. And therefore, I need 30 extra pounds. Somebody yesterday in Anchorage said that. She was a survivor. And she said when she was 7 and her father abused her, she made a decision after repeated abuse that she wanted to weigh 250 pounds. And her weight has stayed at 250 pounds for the past 10 years.
Amazing control of thought.
Even though she's ready to lose weight now, she says, her weight has stayed there because her body's protecting her. And there's something terrifying to her. She hasn't dealt yet with the feelings of terror and rage and violation that she had as a child. And because she hasn't, losing that weight would be terrifying to her. Because to her, she's still in that child state where she believes that she would be vulnerable and at the mercy of people bigger and stronger than her.
That brings us to another topic. Do we all have to be thin and tiny? I mean, the sort of implication, and I really want to talk about this, is if you eat sensibly, if you listen to your body and stop when you're not hungry, only eat when you're hungry, eat in a concentrated way, after a while you'll get in tune with your body and maybe you'll eat sugar and so on, but not to excess. But then you have to face the fact that that we don't all have bodies like Raquel Welch or whatever the male figures are now that have the really desirable bodies. What you seem to be saying also is get to like yourself for who you are. I mean, we come in a tremendous variety of shapes and sizes.
Yes, we do. And two things, Patty, about that. I am saying get to like yourself for who you are, because if you don't begin now and you lose weight, nothing magical is going to happen. You're not going to like yourself anymore when you've lost weight. You think you will, and that's the lure. I will like myself more. But the truth is, if you don't know how to do it now, you're not going to know how to do it then. There's always going to be something, quote, wrong with you.
Right.
The other thing is, no, we don't all have to be the same size. We aren't the same size. Our body weight is determined by quite a few things, not the least of which is heredity. Where our ancestors were from. Were they from cold climates? Were they from warm climates? What kind of bodies did they need? How did they have to use food? How did they have to store their fat? If they were from cold climates, then they needed to store it. My family was from Russia. And, you know, I've got big grandparents. There's that. There's metabolism. There's your environment. There's also how you deal with food. There's a lot going there. And I think what's important is that, no, you don't have to be skinny minis. But there's a difference between being a skinny mini and being at a natural weight. Being at a weight that your body is comfortable at, like a bowl. You know, you can eat more and not gain weight and eat little and not lose weight. Your body reaches a weight that it's comfortable with. And again, a few factors influence that. Exercise does. If you want to consistently get yourself lower than your body's natural weight, then you need to lower your metabolism somehow. I mean, raise your metabolism.
Right.
And exercise is the way to do that.
Set point theory, getting that heart rate up
right.
several times a week, minimum
right.
of 3 and
right.
better 5.
Right.
And
right. But exercise also because it feels good. It feels really good. People who have problems with their bodies don't feel connected to their bodies. They don't own their arms and their legs. They feel like they're walking heads.
Separate entities.
Uh-huh. And so I encourage people to move in a way that feels comfortable for them. Just like I encourage them to eat what they want, I encourage them to find a way of moving that suits their appetite for movement. But to try it out, to try different ways. Because you can't, if you don't like exercise and if you don't like moving and if you've never really gotten into it, then nothing is going to appeal to you. So it's stretching yourself beyond what's comfortable, what's immediately comfortable, but not pushing yourself too far out on the ledge, like saying, okay, I'm going to take an aerobics class 6 times this week and then just needing to go back because that's too much.
So start gently and maybe get used to the idea that at the very beginning you're not going to really love it.
Yeah. But to try things. Try different things. If you don't love this, try this. If you don't like that, try this. Try walking. try skiing, try skating, try dancing. You know, there are swimming. There are just a whole lot of things that you can do.
The diet business in this country is a multi-million, billion-dollar whatever business. Are they happy with you, unhappy with you? Do you think that this will catch hold so firmly that they'll... I mean, set point theory also speaks to this, and there are several books out on that.
Well, I don't know. I know that somebody who owns a chain of diet centers has approached me about buying a franchise of Breaking Free. There are a lot of people from Weight Watch who's come to my lectures. I don't know how thrilled they are with me. If everybody listened to what I said, then there wouldn't be Weight Watchers around. But this program isn't for everybody. So I think what's important is that you do what works for you. And, you know, some people like Weight Watchers. Some people can maintain on Weight Watchers. Some people have been on Weight Watchers for 20 years. Good for them. I think that's wonderful. Do what works for you. And this is for people who have a hard time letting, you know, having that kind of a structure. I need to feel in charge of my life. I get rebellious when somebody tells me what to do. And I question authority at every chance I can get. I am one of those people who need to feel in charge, need to feel powerful.
And this is one way to do it.
Yeah.
And I can tell the radio audience who can't see you that you look wonderful.
Thank you.
Not emaciated.
No.
But certainly not heavy, and things seem in balance for you.
Uh-huh.
And
yeah.
I'm glad they are, and I'm glad that you've chosen to write about it and that some wise publisher, I think Bob's Merrill or something, mm-hmm. chose to publish you even when everyone predicted that no one would publish a book like this that doesn't have a gimmick
right.
and doesn't have a fast right. solution.
Right. Macmillan is now publishing Breaking Free.
Okay, so both those books are available and in print, and they
yes.
are Feeding the Hungry Heart and Breaking Free. And I am very glad you chose to come back to Fairbanks, Janine Roth, and that you brought such fabulous weather with you.
Thanks, Patty. It's been a pleasure.
I hope everybody gets out and enjoys it and that it's lasting. I've been your host for Home Fires Radio Show. My name is Patty Kostelic. Our executive producer is Carla Tanella. Have a very, very nice weekend.